You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson in for Rob Ferret. Tomorrow morning, the U.S. House of Representatives is expected to begin the first day of hearings of the Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. We'll bring you live NPR coverage starting at 8:30 in the morning on WPR's NPR News and Music Network and at WPR.org. Now we are about a month away from the start of a new school year. While Wisconsin school districts plan on returning to in-person learning, they're wrestling over whether students should have to wear masks. That decision comes as the more contagious COVID-19 Delta variant continues to spread. For instance, the Madison School District announced last week that masks would be required in all school buildings, but officials in La Crosse said masks will be optional. That debate is playing out across the country as well. Republican Florida Governor Ron DeSantis recently said he does not support schools requiring students to wear masks.
We got to start putting our kids first. We got to look out for their education. Is it really comfortable? Is it really healthy for them to be muzzled and have their breathing obstructed all day long in school? I don't think it is. And I look to think, I have a 3-year-old son. You got people like Fauci saying he should be muzzled, that you should be throwing masks on these 3-year-old kids. It's totally unacceptable and certainly unacceptable to have any level of government imposing that on parents and on kids.
Again, that is Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. Now, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is recommending masks for everyone 2 years or older who is unvaccinated. And there are other organizations recommending similar mask recommendations. But of course, that's just guidance. In the end, school districts in most states will have to make the call themselves. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see happen in your school district? Should kids be required to wear masks in school? Or do you think that masks might do a little bit more harm than good when it comes to learning? And if you're a parent, what do you think? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can leave us a message on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Now, James Hodge is the Peter Kiewit Foundation Professor of Law at the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law and director of the Center for Public Health Law and Policy at Arizona State University. His areas of expertise include public and global health law, ethics, and human rights. James, welcome back to Central Time.
JC, it's a pleasure to join you. Thank you for having me.
Now, you were on with us not too long ago, and it feels like there has been a lot changing in that time frame. We have this this Delta variant that seems to be spreading very, very rapidly. And this is something, with everything changing, that school districts are going to have to keep in mind. Just how tricky is this for districts as they are trying to plan returning to school within really a month?
Yeah, I know. It's tricky on so many different fronts, JC, for so many reasons. You know, Delta variant is now spreading extensively across the country. You're seeing cases of COVID, and it's all part of the COVID package of different coronaviruses that is impacting the nation still. They're spreading like wildfire. Meanwhile, vaccination rates are slowing down. Consequently, what you have is the potential for, as we reopen schools nationally in all the various different arenas, be it secondary or middle schools or universities, we have the potential for that next big wave. And that's something that nobody in the United States is welcoming or wanting. How do we stop it? And while also allowing for schools to reopen in a way that would be so advantageous for kids. That's the debate that's going on nationally. And there's a lot of legal and policy and ethical issues underlying it.
And it's really not cut or dry. It's not that we've seen haven't seen COVID-19 not impact kids. And it's not as though if you're vaccinated, we haven't seen any breakthrough cases. There's just what feels like so many moving parts. Now, according to CNN, at least 9 states, all with Republican governors, have laws against school districts requiring mask mandates. Our neighbor to the west, Iowa, has one. Do those laws tend to be ironclad, or will there be some wiggle room within those laws?
It's a great point. And I'm in one of those states, too, here in Arizona. And to be sure, we're looking at provisions, you know, not just in Arizona, but the other states you mentioned that we wouldn't want to call ironclad in the sense that there will be no opportunity whatsoever for masks to be worn. They simply won't allow it to occur. What you are seeing, though, is a generalized policy approach to say, until you show us evidence that we need to wear these masks again, we're not going to allow it. As you saw Governor DeSantis making similar statements, calling people and kids muzzled if they would have to wear masks again, and similar statements you've seen in other arenas. The idea and premise behind it is that some states now are basically saying, you're going to have to show us more before we're going to institute a mask requirement that's already something Americans are tired of. They've grown weary of. A lot of persons, maybe the same who are not vaccinated, also don't want to wear masks, and they don't want their kids wearing masks when they get there. What does it all boil down to, JC? Preventable cases of COVID-19, not just among those kids, but among everybody around them. Kids are particularly good vectors of disease, especially conditions like COVID-19.
We are talking to James Hodge right now. He's the Peter Kiewit Foundation Professor of Law at the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law at Arizona State University. And we are taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What do you think of masks in schools? Should it be required, or should parents have more of a say in how their kids return to school in the fall? We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page, and we will continue this conversation in a minute and take your calls right here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson, and right now we continue our conversation about whether or not schools should require masks when in-person learning resumes in many school districts this fall. And we are going to be taking your calls at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. James Hodge is our guest. He's a professor of law at the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law and director of the Center for Public Health Law and Policy at Arizona State University. Now, James, before we went to the break, we were talking about the school, not the schools, but the states that have these laws on the books right now as school districts are trying to figure out what they're going to be doing in the fall. And you said that they weren't ironclad, but do we have a sense, and I know that this is kind of a big question, of how it might be enforced if it comes out that schools are requiring masks, maybe not saying requiring, but could there be some backlash in states where these laws saying you can't mandate it are on the books?
Yeah, exactly. It's raising a great point. What are you going to tell a school that actually goes against that particular guidance and basically does more to protect the health of those students, those teachers, all of the visitors within the school, and everybody in that community by asking, you know, the persons within the environment to wear a mask? That's going to be consistent with, I dare say, CDC guidance at that point in time. Remember, kids can't be vaccinated right now, so they are susceptible to potential infection. And as a result, they can carry that back to their parents and otherwise. What or how are we going to actually deal with a school that's doing above and beyond what we would hope for, at least see in some of these state laws, to protect the public's health? It's almost antithetical to think we're going to come down hard on those schools in any particular district that are doing more, providing better safety and better efforts. It's going to be interesting, but I dare say one of the things you will see are certain state authorities doing exactly what we've suggested here, coming down hard on schools that don't give students and teachers and others the freedom to not wear masks. It's going to be a very interesting fall as you see outbreaks of COVID-19 and the Delta variant show up in these school districts.
I want to go to one of our callers right now. We have John in Madison. Hi, John.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Your guest has already made kind of the points that I was going to say. I think they absolutely should wear masks in schools because these kids aren't islands unto themselves. They bring this through their communities as well. But not only that, the Delta variant, as I've heard, is much more impactful on younger people than the previous variants have been. And I just think it's almost hypocritical of Ron DeSantis to say that the science is settled with vaccines and that they're great for people, and that trying to encourage his populace to get the vaccine, and then say that, no, you're not allowed to wear a mask in school. That's just crazy.
John, thank you so much for that call. You know, what do you think? What do you think of John's point, James?
Well, I like John's point a lot. You can't hardly be a governor saying, let's get vaccinated and let's do it immediately, because we're not going to wear masks ever again. It doesn't comport with public health science, public health reasoning, or logic. But what it does reflect, if you're kind of wondering, well, why are these, you know, why are political actors making these sort of judgments and statements? We're 18 months into this pandemic, virtually. People are tired. People are worn out. People don't want any more of the sort of social distancing or mask requirements. I mean, we all have seen and felt that in various different environments, from Wisconsin to every other state across the U.S. So I think you're seeing political appeasement of persons trying to say, let's get back to some level of normalcy until you show us a reason why we have to take on additional measures, a.k.a. now we've got a serious outbreak of COVID-19 again, and we're going to lose a lot of Americans as a result. It's predictable that could occur based on some of these political statements you're seeing, and that's some of what we're really trying to hash out and think through, how to stop that from occurring. We do not need to lose additional Americans to these policies.
We're talking to James Hodge right now, professor of law at the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law at Arizona State University. So we've been using Republican Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida as an example through our conversation. But Florida is not one of those nine states that has a ban on schools imposing mask mandates. But I want to hear now from White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki, because she was asked about Governor DeSantis's comments about against masking kids. You know, here's what she had to say.
Well, as a parent myself, and I know you are one, if I were a parent in Florida, that would be greatly concerning to me, because kids under the age of 12 are not vaccinated. They're not eligible yet. As the president said last night, obviously it's going to be led by the FDA, but certainly we hope that will be soon. But that puts kids at risk. It's not aligned with public health guidelines. We know masks are not the most comfortable thing. I will say my kids are quite adjusted to them, as I know many kids are. So certainly we would have concern about any step that doesn't abide by public health guidelines, and we think it puts people at greater risk.
So, you know, we're hearing some different guidance from different organizations. The American Academy of Pediatrics says one thing. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say another. Do you think that there is some mixed messaging here that might make it a little bit different for school districts or even state legislatures to craft a policy that works?
Great point, JC. I mean, mixed messages have been a component of this pandemic from day one. And we've all been trying to actually negotiate and think through, where's the best science on this? What's the best public health intervention? From a legal and ethical perspective, however, the one thing that speaks truth and volumes in any community is we've got expanded number of COVID cases now, and we could have stopped it. The preventive measures that are going to be there, I think, are going to be put on trial again as we reopen schools. And so what it really boils down to, without getting to the epidemiology of it, which I'd be deferential to CDC and Wisconsin public health authorities on completely, is what can you legally do? And what do you legally have to do? You have to run a safe school. That's required under state law in every jurisdiction. Schools need to be safe, and making them safe means eliminating to the degree possible infectious disease outbreaks. We have vaccination requirements for that for years. We have multiple other safety mechanisms in place. It's like we're approaching COVID-19 like it's a different threat or something that we have to treat with greater political attention. It's the same type of threat that what we see regularly, and yet it's being treated now because of, I think, general apathy in the population, as if we're just going to combat it with tools that we simply aren't going to use. It's a nice way of restating, basically, we know what to do to keep these schools safe. We're just politically not quite ready to do it any longer.
Now, in that vein, James, are you aware of any states that are doing the opposite of what we've heard those other states doing, where they're putting these mask mandates in, or they're banning mask mandates, but where states might be really towing the CDC line and maybe requiring some school districts to do this?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You're starting to see that crop up in many jurisdictions. And California hits my mind as far as one of the top ones. L.A. just reinstituted its mask mandate after it dropped it a few weeks ago. It did it because of rising numbers of COVID cases. And it's doing so against that backdrop in school districts and places of that nature, because they're recognizing This is now a temporary situation. We are now getting to a threshold of potential hopeful herd immunity with vaccines. If and when those vaccines are fully approved by FDA for utilization among smaller person or younger persons, we can reach that herd immunity level very well in the U.S. So as a result, yeah, you're starting to see some districts actually come around to saying, you know, straight up, we're going to require these masks going into the start of the season, but at least we're convening again physically in an actual place and not virtually. That's a step up for a lot of districts coming off of last year's just absolutely horrendous school year for a lot of kids.
Now, we've seen sort of state by state examples of this. States typically have control over their school districts. Could there be any federal intervention? And if so, what would that even look like?
Yeah, that's a great question, JC. One of the things that we want to be deferential to at the federal level, and I don't speak for the federal government in this discussion or any other, but let's be sure. We want to be deferential to how schools are run by, first of all, local authorities, and then at the state level, how the states come into play. We want to be deferential to that, but the feds as well don't have to sit and watch COVID-19 spread across the country again, because we want to take on different approaches to how we'll operate those schools. Consequently, there are things that feds could do that could get a little heavier for states and localities in regards to how they might actually run their school in the near future. For example, conditioning federal receipt of Department of Education funds on assuring as safe and effective of an environment for those kids to reconvene as possible. It's a heavier technique. It's a little heavy-handed, but we do it all the time at the federal level in relation to what conditions we're going to set for receipt of those funds that make sure your school at the local level is running, you know, consistent with everything from anti-discrimination protections to public health initiatives, just like you're seeing with COVID-19.
Well, James, unfortunately, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
JC, a real pleasure. Thank you for having me.
James Hodge is a professor of law and the director of the Center for Public Health Law and Policy at Arizona State University. We talked with him about the legal and ethical issues over whether kids should have to wear masks in school when in-person learning resumes this fall. Now, a Wisconsin Watch and Wisconsin Public Radio investigation has found that an Outagamie County judge used sentencing practices, which some experts say are legally questionable. Judge Vince Biskupic has offered stays or furloughs in at least 30 cases, allowing people to avoid jail time if they follow his rules. Phoebe Petrovic explains.
After the Wisconsin Department of Corrections revoked Bo James' probation, he went before Outagamie County Circuit Judge Vincent Biskupic to receive his sentence. Biskupic is well known in legal circles. He was the Outagamie County District Attorney for 8 years and unsuccessfully ran for Attorney General in 2002. Biskupic gave James a year in jail. The next month, he let James back out, provided he complied with 5 rules.
At first, I was happy about it. You know, I got to save my apartment. I got to save what I've earned, what I've worked so hard for.
Every few months, Biskupic ordered the young man back to court to ask if he was working, getting counseling, staying sober, and above all, studying for his GED. Skipping these check-ins could have landed James back in jail, so he went.
I had everything going for myself, but he continued and continued and continued because I didn't have my GED.
For 19 months, James lived in a sort of legal purgatory, tethered to Biskupic's court by review hearings and rules, and burdened by the remaining jail sentence hanging over his head. Biskupic used a stay, a tool which pauses or postpones a sentence. Wisconsin law allows judges to stay sentences to put people on probation with the Department of Corrections, but that's not what this was, because the department had already revoked James' probation.
Pretty much what the stay was still continuing probation just through the judge.
More than 24 attorneys, judges, and law professors interviewed had mixed opinions about whether this practice, used by a handful of judges in Wisconsin, is legal. Several said they had never encountered it. Biskupic did not answer detailed questions about the practice. In a statement, he said he considers all sentencing options, including ways for defendants to attend treatment. In an email, Biskupic's attorney defended the judge's actions, insisting that earlier court rulings permit them. Cecilia Klingel is a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Law School. She described Biskupic's review hearings as a gray area of the law.
Clearly, what the courts are trying to do here is create alternative sentencing mechanisms, which on their merits may be terrific, whether they can stand or whether we need statutory revision in order for them to be recognized. Is just not entirely clear.
Wisconsin law limits the types of sentences judges can issue. But Brown County Circuit Judge Donald Zeidmulder says you won't find these arrangements in the statutes. He says they're rare but legal.
This is just part of what comes with judicial authority. We're a third branch, and so we do have some inherent powers.
Others disagree. Deja Vishny, a defense attorney and adjunct professor at Marquette University Law School, reviewed appeals and Supreme Court rulings that Biskupic's attorney says authorized these unusual arrangements.
So there are really limited circumstances under which it can be done. But deciding that you're going to be the probation agent for the person is not one of them. So he just has absolutely no authority to do what he's doing.
Still, some attorneys and defendants say they appreciated the arrangement, especially if they got to avoid jail. Biskupic's oversight had fewer rules than regular probation, but also fewer checks and balances on the judge's power. Bo James considered appealing after Biskupic sent him back to jail, but his attorney worried the ordeal might end before a higher court could weigh in. James later sued Biskupic in federal court, alleging the stay was illegal, but a magistrate judge threw it out. For Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Phoebe Petrovic.
Coming up, a DNR ecologist found a plant previously thought to have vanished in Wisconsin in the mid-20th century. He joins the program to share what this can tell us about biodiversity in the state. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson, and you are listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, lots of people are looking for hands-on hobbies right now to get away from our screens. We talk with two adults who enjoy recreationally and competitively building with Lego sets. That's coming up in just a little bit. Now, earlier this month, DNR conservation biologist Ryan O'Connor went on a surveying trip looking for rare species in Wisconsin, and that's exactly what he found when he spotted a patch of green violet. That's a plant that scientists thought had disappeared from Wisconsin altogether. The last time anyone saw it in the state was in 1958. Ryan O'Connor joins us now. As mentioned, he's with the DNR. He's with the Bureau of Natural Heritage Conservation. Ryan, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, welcome. Thank you, JC. Thanks for having
me. So it feels like, Ryan, a big moment to find this plant that seems to have totally disappeared for more than half a century. Can you bring us back to the moment where you made this discovery and what it was like?
Yeah, it was really amazing. It was early May. It was a beautiful spring day. I was in one of our state natural areas, a state-owned property that's managed for conservation purposes in west central Wisconsin. And it was carpeted with a lot of spring ephemeral wildflowers, things like Trillium and Dutchman's Breeches and Spring Beauty. And as I was doing our survey looking for other rare species, I looked up and saw this plant that I knew was different. And as I got a closer look at it, I realized it was green violet. And my heart skipped a beat a little bit. It was because I was familiar with it, but I also knew it was hadn't been seen in an exceptionally long time. So it was a very special moment.
Yeah, so this is a plant that hasn't been officially seen in the state since the late 1950s. And of course, it's possible that someone saw it but didn't know what it was. For the layperson, can you describe what it looks like?
Yeah, it is a woodland wildflower. It stands about 8 to 12 inches tall. And unlike, it's in the violet family, but unlike the showy violets that grew up in our lawns and that we're familiar with on some of our woodlots, it has a little tiny flower that is green. So the flower is green. The all of the flower parts are green. The leaves are green. And so that's where it gets its scientific name, Hibanthus concolor, meaning like the same color. So everything is sort of the same color on the plant. But the flowers are unique in that they hang underneath the leaves, which is kind of an uncommon, place for a flower to be. And certainly unlike all of our other violet species.
And, you know, they thought that this plant had basically disappeared. Where did it go? How did it disappear?
Yeah, it was known from a woodlot in Grant County before. That's the only place that it had been, documented for with any precision in the state. And unfortunately, that woodland had been grazed over time. So a lot of cattle kind of getting, into the woods, which, we need, farmers need places to raise their livestock. But unfortunately, it was too much for the green violet at that locality. And it winked out, and despite many years, many people going back to that place to search for it, it had never been found before, and so therefore it was sort of presumed to be extirpated, or what that means is essentially locally extinct within a jurisdiction. So in this case, none left in the state of Wisconsin.
Now, what do you think this says about you've made this discovery? It's a really big deal. What do you think this will do for conservation efforts in Wisconsin?
Yeah, that's a great question, JC. I think it really highlights the fact that there are a lot of discoveries still to be made. There is a lot of land in Wisconsin. There are a lack of skilled people out in the woods and the prairies and the wetlands searching for these rare species, documenting common species, so that's not just rare plants, but it can also mean birds, butterflies, bumblebees. And we still have so much to learn and to document about many of our rare species. So our hope is that it generates a tremendous amount of interest when we have a story like this. But my colleagues, are out in these habitats every day, doing their own surveys for rare species, but also doing a lot of the hard work that it takes to keep these areas nice. We find rare species with some frequency, but we tend to find them on areas where invasive species have been carefully removed, where prairies and savannas have been managed with prescribed fire, where brush has been cut out of them, and the areas have received the type of stewardship that takes, and it takes a tremendous amount of effort. So our hope is that as people learn more about this, they get interested in managing their own property, removing invasives from their own woodlots, planting native species, joining volunteer work days to help care for parks and state natural areas and other high quality habitats.
Ryan, we'll have to leave it there for now, but thank you so much for joining us and congratulations on this find.
Thank you so much.
Ryan O'Connor is a conservation biologist at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources Bureau of Natural Heritage Conservation. He joined us to talk about his discovery of the green violet, which ecologists thought had disappeared from the state altogether. The last time it was seen was in 1958. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCullum with a story about a newspaper vendor.
More than 20,000 people in Wisconsin experience homelessness. That's according to a 2019 report from the Institute for Community Alliances. Among those are vendors for Street Pulse Newspaper, a Dane County publication whose mission is to amplify the voices of individuals experiencing homelessness and encourage advocacy in the community. WPR's Alyssa Alamand introduces us to one of the Street Pulse vendors.
Whenever I go to Trader Joe's, there are three things always on my grocery list: matcha ice cream, a couple boxes of chicken tikka masala, and a copy of Street Pulse newspaper. If you too are a frequent Trader Joe's shopper on Madison's west side, you may have noticed Chris Hubbard, a vendor for Street Pulse, who spends his day selling newspapers.
Well, it's been an easier winter so far, so pretty lucky.
Hubbard has been experiencing homelessness for 10 years. Before that, he worked in the Capital newspaper's press room, which happens to be where issues of Street Pulse are printed. Hubbard says it's hard to find employment after losing a job because once something is on your record, it's there for all future employers to see. But with Street Pulse...
Well, the Pulse was the only job that all I had to do was walk in and shake a guy's hand and I was hired, like the olden days. So the first couple years I was like some of the other homeless, like sitting on the bench all day, not really doing anything, hanging out at the library. So this was doing something, you know, not real hard work, just holding a paper and hoping someone will buy a couple, you know.
Thank you.
Karen Andrew is the former editor-in-chief of the newspaper and former president of the Street Pulse Board of Directors.
The topic of homelessness is so diverse and complex. It isn't one issue, not a cookie-cutter problem, and it's not a cookie-cutter solution. What I'm hopeful about is in Madison and Dane County, in our continuum of care, I'm seeing very big changes in representation of individuals who are sharing voice at the policy level, people's experience of barriers.
Street Pulse is run by volunteers. Vendors purchase newspapers for 50 cents per copy to then sell the issues around Madison. Their income is the tips they make from selling the papers. The suggested donation from the public is $1 per copy, but any amount is welcome. Like most things, the pandemic has had an impact on Street Pulse.
Yeah, the COVID thing, it did mess the job up, but hopefully we all survive it and go back to what we were doing before.
Joel Gerard is the current president of Street Pulse's board of directors and lead guest service specialist at The Beacon, a resource center for people without homes in Madison. He says capacity restrictions at businesses has been the hardest part of the pandemic for Street Pulse vendors. They aren't always allowed to sell on businesses' property because they would count as one of their guests. Another obstacle, both amid the pandemic and prior, is having enough writers to fill an issue of the newspaper.
So we used to do them monthly, but we're just not having the articles to write right now and the writers, but that's kind of been a big draw too. You know, no one wants to buy a paper that only has like two pages.
Back at Trader Joe's, Hubbard is having a good sales day. When he doesn't have newspapers to sell, he relies on photography prints to bring in some cash.
Oh yeah, the duck photos are been really popular this morning. White morning glory flower, got a lot of them out.
The backs of the photos all say the same: stay happy, smiley face, from Chris Hubbard.
You know, I don't have to have every refrigerator in Wisconsin have my photo, but that would be kind of, my ego then would increase with if every house. And
well, there, I think I have three of your photos on my fridge.
Oh, great.
So you got me.
Some people may want the paper, some people may want just a photo. And then I like to keep everybody happy and maximize my money too at the same time.
And with that money, he tries to take a trip every year to visit his mother in Florida, which he said is an opportunity to relax, compensate for Wisconsin winters, and shower twice a day.
WPR's Alyssa Alamand brought us that story on Street Pulse newspaper. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, Lego sets are not just for kids. We talk with two Midwest competitors on the Lego Masters show about why so many adults have found joy in what's usually thought of as a childhood toy. That's next, right here on Central Time.
This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Tomorrow morning, the U.S. House of Representatives is expected to begin the first day of hearings of the Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. We'll bring you live NPR coverage starting at 8:30 a.m. on WPR's NPR News and Music Network. You can also stream that on WPR.org. Now, many of us grew up playing with Lego sets and building with Lego bricks for hours as kids, but some people have rekindled their love for building as adults. And there's a word for that called AFOL, or adult fan of Lego, and that's spelled A-F-O-L. Our next guests self-identify as AFOLs and say Lego sets became a hot item in the last pandemic year for people of all ages, including adults who might be rekindling that passion. And they're not just Lego fans. They're also contestants on season 2 of the Lego Masters TV show on Fox. On the show, they've had to build items that can withstand an earthquake or an exact replica of a Lamborghini made of Lego bricks from memory. Philip and Maria Stratzma are known as the Midwest builders in the Lego world. They're members of the Wisconsin Lego User Group, also known as WISLUG. Philip and Maria, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yes, thank you so much.
So Maria, let's start with you. Did you ever imagine that your interest in building things with Lego bricks would be what got you on TV? Actually, this question is for both of you.
This is a fun question, because I actually remember saying this once to Philip earlier. I said, you know, if you had asked me 5 years ago what reality show I might be on, Lego wouldn't have been anywhere on the radar. But, you know, it's something that we've been doing together for the last couple years. He's been doing it much longer than I have, but we just love doing it together, and it seemed like a good fit, and the show was just so much fun.
Well, Philip, then, if you've been doing this for a long time, maybe a little bit longer than Maria, think back to some of these challenges. Just how stressful are they, or do you feel very cool under the pressure?
So I think when you first kind of start off and you're given the challenge, your mind is going at like a million miles an hour, trying to figure out what you're going to do and what you're going to build. After that initial kind of like freak out of, oh my goodness, we have to build something in a very short period of time and make it look awesome, then you kind of settle down a little bit and you kind of work into a groove. I think us being a little bit older too, we've had dealt with stress in the world and life before. So that helps a bit, I think.
It also feels, if I could jump in, it feels almost like it could, even though it's a little stressful, a little bit meditative, because you have to focus on this task. Maria, have you experienced that, or am I just going out on a limb there?
No, you're absolutely right, especially in terms of being on the show. You know, when we first walked into the set, there's all these cameras all over the place, and you're trying desperately not to look at the cameras. And then as soon as they gave us the challenge, it was like all the cameras disappeared and you weren't thinking so much about what everybody else is doing. You're just thinking, okay, how can we figure out what we're going to do? How can we implement it and get done on time?
Totally. You've got to get it all done within that time frame. Right now, we're talking to Philip and Maria Stratzma. They are known as the Midwest Builders. They're on season 2 of the show Lego Masters, and they are based in Michigan. Now, to both of you, I know, Philip, that you've been doing this for a while, but how did you get interested in Lego building as adults?
Wait, so when Maria was pregnant with our oldest, who's now 11, my parents actually brought my like Lego collection as a child back to me at the place we were living at the time. And I initially just thought I was going to put it into storage. But turns out I opened up the box of Lego bricks, and honestly, I just never closed it back up again. From there, it just kind of blew up into a hobby and turned into us attending conventions together as a family, and has been a pastime for the four of us and our family, to be honest.
That sounds really great. How did you, Maria, how did you get your kids involved? How did this become a family endeavor?
Well, you know, as a mom, you're always excited about buying things for your kids, like toys. And it's always extra exciting when it's something you can play with, too. And so, I mean, I can remember buying them Duplo sets and then as they got older, getting them the traditional Lego brick sets. And so that was a big way that we got the whole family involved. And with going to the conventions on a regular basis, now our kids are building not just sets, but their own creations as well. And like our son has just recently made a couple really cool robots that he's just super proud of. And it's just so fun to see that passion and that creativity grow in them.
Now, Philip, sticking with that, when it comes to building things, especially, I believe they're called mocks or my own creations, you're hearing about your kids developing it, but how do you develop your own style of building?
That's actually a great question. And I think it's just something kind of happens over time. So each builder, as they kind of start off, they remember, I think, a lot of the sets they like to play with as a child. So whether it be castles or pirates or space or something like that, they tend to start off in that genre of building and then move on from there as they find more interest. And honestly, something that we find that's really interesting is the things that we look at and we build, inspiration kind of comes from everywhere, to be honest. So that's one of the things about building with Lego is that you're not really limited to a specific thing like space or castle or pirate. Like if you want to move on to something beyond that, like if you want to make like a hardware store or you want to make like a fantasy scene or something like that, that's completely possible. And there's no real limitation other than what is your imagination.
Now, Maria, we've seen a lot of growth in hobby and play industries in the last year. Do you think that the adult Lego community is growing?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, it was growing a lot to begin with, just from the time we went to our first convention in 2013 until, before the last time we went, which was before COVID. But just with the last year, I think a lot of people were kind of stuck at home. They were looking for an outlet, for something to do that would be creative. And a lot of people were seeing these amazing new Lego sets that Lego was creating. And they were buying them and they were putting them together and it was taking them back to their childhood. And now you're seeing a lot of people who have traditionally just been set builders, like myself, who are now venturing out and taking those pieces and trying to put together something that's new and it's different and that represents them.
Maria, if I can stay with you for a second, how would you describe your style?
Well, you know, collectively, the two of us really love anything fantasy. And Philip started building out castles, and he loved to use a lot of grays and browns and earth tones. And then I came in and I started putting like punches of purple and pink and green and blue. And so we love to create architecture a lot in the medieval style and try to make them look really lifelike and organic.
Now, Philip, you both live in Michigan, and you're actually a part of the Wisconsin Lego Users Group. Can you talk about what it's like to have that community across Lake Michigan?
Yeah, actually, it's a fantastic group of individuals. And one thing that modern technology has really afforded us is the ability to communicate over tools that are not just like a telephone or whatever. So we have a lot of online communications that go on between the group, whether it's collaborating on something or we're doing like a social get together or something like that. It's been really nice, especially again, coming out of the pandemic when we couldn't see each other in person. But yeah, it was actually kind of funny back in one of the conventions we were at, we got adopted by Wislog of all things and such a great group of individuals and we're honored to be part of them.
Now, Maria, I imagine that at some point this can become a bit of a pricey hobby. I mean, I guess over the last year as well, because this was a really hot commodity. Can you talk about the money involved, but some of the digital alternatives to keep the cost down?
Yeah. So, yes, Lego is notoriously very expensive. One of my favorite things to do is hunt down sets that have a really good, what we call price per brick. So you're getting more bricks, more bang for your buck, so to speak. I love to hunt down those sets, clearance sets. We also will buy pieces in bulk whenever we can, which you can do at the Lego store or you can do through a user group. So it's great to get a lot of one piece, which you love to have when you're building a big thing. But you're right. So it can be really expensive. It can be cost prohibitive. But one of the really amazing things that's come out of the Lego community is there are platforms where you can build entirely digitally. So all you need is a computer, which most people have, and you can put together whatever you want. Like, the world is your oyster when it comes to building digitally, because the entire catalog of both pieces and colors is in there. So it's a different skill set for sure, but it's a really fun one to try.
Philip, we only have about 15 seconds left. When can we see you both on the next episode of Lego Masters?
Yeah, so we're currently on a two-week break right now for the Olympics. But after that, things will pick right back up and we'll get on with episode 7 on Fox 17. Or Fox, sorry.
On Fox, yeah. Well, we'll stick with just Fox. So Philip and Maria, thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Philip and Maria Stratzma, also known as the Midwest Builders, are season 2 contestants of the Fox show Lego Masters. They're also members of the Wisconsin Lego user group known as Wislug. Now, twin brothers Jacob and Caleb Schilling of Holman, Wisconsin, are also one of the pairs competing on this season of the show. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us this afternoon.